Let's make sure that history never forgets the name.
Sci-Fi Malady.
Got out.
Space. Exciting and new. Come aboard in a cryogenic tube. Space. 120 years on board, you will go to Homestead 2, Avalon. Soon you'll be sleeping in space, Avalon. Promises a new life for you. Set a course for Homestead 2 for a brand new second chance. Space, it's never a bore. Nothing for many miles or oxygen anymore. Space, now you will travel in space.
Sci-Fi Malady, symptom 183, passengers, Titanic in space.
And welcome back, sickies, to our next month of sanguine sci-fi. That's right, we're covering all the love in space. All right, I gotta stop trying to be some kind of 1970s romantic DJ. No more of that.
Anyway. Thank you.
Yeah, I immediately felt horrible. So anyway,
welcome
let's
back
get into
to Sanguine Sci-Fi. Did anyone order a pizza?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was feeling like. So let's not do that again. Anyway, because February has Valentine's Day, I thought let's do some romance in space. Because and really kind of, you know, what was the inspiration for this, guys? Remember at the end of Back to the Future 2, what novel did George McFly write? What was the name of his novel?
I should remember this, but I don't.
It was called A Match Made in Space.
That's right.
And it had on the cover, a guy in a radiation suit because Marty came to him in that vision, in that dream, right? And said he was Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan, and that if he didn't, George didn't ask out Lorraine, he would melt his brain after playing Van Halen in his ears. And, you know, so that kind of made me think, man, if A Match Made in Space were really a novel, I'd want to read it just to see the madness of Crispin Glover, which, yeah, he's unusual. But unfortunately, that is not a book, so we're just going to have to stick with the films we have in front of us. And that today is Passengers, starring, all of a sudden I forget their name, Chris Pratt
and Jennifer
Chris
Lawrence.
Pratt, Star-Lord and Jennifer Lawrence, yeah. So we have Guardians of the Galaxy
don't,
and
don't
Hunger.
Don't forget about Morpheus.
Oh yeah, Morpheus is in it, but you kind of...
Really? I don't count... Like yeah. That little bit.
Yeah, you know how exactly. You will if you know how much money he got paid for that.
Well, that's a good question. How much did he get paid for that?
Well, let me first tell you that Chris Pratt got $12 million for the lead.
Okay. Yeah.
Morpheus got $20 million plus 30% of the profit after the film breaks even.
And he's not even in it that long.
He got $20 million against 30% of the profit after the film breaks even. So I think that's insane.
Good on him.
I know, right? I don't know how he managed to – him or his agent are really good.
Michael Sheen playing Arthur the bartender was a great role. And then this one made no sense to me. They have Andy Garcia playing the walk-on role, the captain of the ship, not saying anything, just appearing on screen for a few seconds.
Uh-huh. Right at the end, yeah.
Andy Garcia. They had to get Andy Garcia for that role? What did that cost?
What's the budget on this film?
$100 million.
And how much did it make?
$300 million.
Which, I guess... So, of course, we don't know what marketing cost, but it probably did make money, even if it wasn't that much.
Yeah.
So,
Lawrence Fishburne, man, I mean, that's amazing. I mean,
it is. Now, I do know that it didn't get that high of a rating. I think it got like a 31% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
31% too high.
31% too high. If there's. Which, by the way, Stickies, if you're wondering how Scott feels about it, he just tipped his hand already. So I want to get some fun facts about the movie before we jump in. I'm going to give some fun facts, the plot, and then we'll do what we do. So there is a plot. There is a story.
Oh, there's a plot to this one.
There is. So. One of the fun facts, Emma Clark, who does the voice on the Starship Avalon, actually also does one of the Mind the Gap voices on the London subway. It's probably how she got the gig. I wouldn't be surprised. So another little fun fact, Aurora, which is Jennifer Lawrence's character, she is named after Sleeping Beauty, Aurora, because she was sleeping in beauty. Ha ha ha. That was clever. But this film has actually been kicked around in Hollywood since 2007. It was never really picked up until Sony finally picked it up. And it was originally supposed to have, for a hot minute, it was supposed to be done by Weinstein Company. And it was set to have Keanu Reeves and Reese Witherspoon as the leads for a modest $35 million budget on top of it.
I'm not sure they would have done a better job.
No, I actually feel like this one was better than that would have been.
And you would have had to have gotten rid of Morpheus because those two can never be in the same film again.
Yeah, I don't think Keanu Reeves could have pulled it off. But then again, this is me. And honestly, Keanu Reeves will, with the exception of Neo, he will never cease to be Ted. He is just burned into my brain as Ted.
See, that,
as
that's
Ted or Logan.
See, I think of him first as Neo, and then I think of him as Footsteps Falco in The Replacements, and then I think of him as the guy driving the bus, not the guy driving the bus, Jack.
Speed.
In Speed, yeah.
It's John Wick now for me, but yeah.
Yeah, see, but and I get that. And all of those I could get, but just for me, it's burned in my brain, Ted Theodore Logan. And it's not fair, but that's what it is.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, it's not. We also basically got Star-Lord here in this version.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, that's the other thing with Chris Pratt. He's always going to be either a combination of Star-Lord or Andy Dwyer. From Parks and Rec. That's what he's going to be. And so when I see him, I just keep thinking, okay, he's supposed to mess up and be goofy. 3, 2, 1. Nope. He's just having a cup of coffee.
You know, we could have called this Chris Pratt February because if we're doing her, he's going to return.
No, he wasn't in that movie.
According to his filmography here in 2013, he was Paul in Her.
All right. So, but he wasn't the lead in that movie. He wasn't the lead in that.
Okay.
Another little interesting note was for the, I'll just call up spade a spade for the sex scene. Apparently Jennifer Lawrence had to get loaded because it was bizarre and awkward. And was followed by anxiety and guilt. So she had to really get liquored up to do that one. Some might say with Chris Pratt, well, I don't know. I'm not going to get into that.
It's a PG-13 scene, though. It wasn't even like a rated R scene.
I know, but I'm just saying.
There must have been some real, awkwardness issues between the two of them, and I don't know what it is, but wow.
Yeah. So, well, and if it depends on your sensibilities, I guess. So, and she just didn't want to do that, I guess. So, and I guess the final point I'll just make before I dive on into the story is, if you look at the movie poster underneath the titles, it contains Morse code that says SOS. There's a fun fact. But so let me dive in then to the story. And I'm going to try to really do a minute here. So let me time myself and you guys can call me on it. Because it's been a while since I've had to do that, especially last month, given the fact that Scott, that was all you given the story because, well, we didn't really cover the plots, but if we did, it was on you, Scott. So I'm going to try this. Okay.
All right.
I'm going to take a crack at it. And 3, 2, 1, go. So there's a guy named Jim Preston, and he's on a ship called the Avalon headed to Homestead 2. And I guess he's a welder or something. I forget. And he's on a trip that should take 120 years, but 30 years in, an asteroid hits this near destructible ship, so they say, and it wakes him up early. So he gets out and he walks around and just kind of gets used to the place. And then he starts learning about the only other person he could talk to is the automaton bartender Arthur. And what he learns is he finds one of the other passengers in a pod named Aurora. And he falls in love with her and makes a malfunction to wake her up. And together they work out on the ship together and yada, 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 fall in love. But then she comes to find out that he woke her up early because he was alone. She hates him, doesn't want to be anywhere near him. But then because of the asteroid hit, the reactor is overloading and there's causing cascade failures. So the two of them have to work together. Oh, and during that time, Gus Mancuso, who happens to be a member of the crew, wakes up and tells them how to fix the problem. But he gets injured he's dying because as a result of being woken up too early. So he gives them the key card. They work together. They vent some stupid gas from the reactor and they wind up getting back together. And although they do learn at the end that Aurora could go into one of the air tubes and put herself back to sleep, but she decides to stay with Jim and they live happily ever after. And Aurora, who is a journalist, records her life with him in a book. And then they build a garden in the main concourse of the ship. And when everyone else wakes up, the place is a nice garden with her story of what they did, what they went through playing overhead. The end.
A minute 45.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Well, still pretty good. Still, you know, yeah, I covered all the bases.
And he's a mechanic, is a meteor, not an asteroid. And it was not because he got woken up, but because he got woken up improperly.
Ah, okay. Lord Gus, that is. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Rage Master, did I catch an Easter egg in there somewhere, though?
What's that?
There was an homage to something in there. Vent stupid.
That I said, or was.
Vent the stupid one. Gas to The Simpsons.
Yes,
vent
it was.
Stupid that gas. Y-E-S.
Yes. Yes.
That would be an accidental Easter egg to The Simpsons because I was just watching that episode this week.
Ah.
So. Yeah, that was an accidental reference to Homer having to vent his stupid gas.
Makes sense. But yeah,
venting gas prevents explosion. All right,
you pretty much got the gist of the story down.
That noise you may have heard in the background was my dog breaking through the studio door like the Kool-Aid Man. She likes to do that.
Yeah, nothing new there. So now that we got the story out of the way, we are going to get to rips and pick sickies, but there was something that I overheard Thomas and Scott talking about that I think is at the core of this story before we can get into rips and picks. And that is, let's talk about the relationship between Jim and Aurora, because there's something fundamentally wrong with it. And Scott, since I heard you, why don't you kick us off with that? What was your issue?
This is supposed to be a true love story, a love story from among the stars and Titanic in space. And it's not. He's drunk. He's depressed. And he sees an attractive blonde girl in a tube and he falls in love with her body. After that, he tries to find out about her. And then they say because he read all of her novels, he fell in love with her. He fell in love with her physical appearance. And they're making this out to be like, he fell in love with her. And then the first thing they do, which is terrible writing, The first thing they do is have them demonstrate how incompatible they are for each other. When he's saying, how do you know that? And do you know, she, I know people. And he's proving that she doesn't know people and that she's from this rich, snobby world where she had everything and he had to work his way up and he's just a person with useful skills. These two have nothing in common. If they weren't stranded in the middle of space together, they'd never be together. And then, even when she's going to stay with him, as soon as Morpheus is awake, she wants him arrested for murder. But as soon as she realizes Morpheus is going to die and she's going to have to spend 88 years alone, she wants to make sure he comes back. She doesn't love him. She loves the idea of not being alone. It's a terrible love story. It's one guy who's lusting after a woman and a woman who says, this creep who lusted after me woke me up and lied to me so that he had some companionship and wants to get in my pants. I'm going to be okay because he's the only thing here. It's terrible. It's one guy saying he has true love over lust, and it's a woman saying, well, he's the one guy that is here, so good enough, I'll settle for him, and we'll call it true love. God, I hope none of you ever get stuck in that relationship.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, but, you know, Thomas had some comments on that, too. Thomas, go on and add in before I chip in.
Well, it's... My comments were basically that, but also the idea of this was like, yes, let's basically put two people who aren't from the social, same social classes, anything close to it, don't have the same likes, anything. And the only reason at all they're together is because they're the only two people on this spaceship awake. Great. That doesn't exactly go true love as much as practicality of it's like, oh, yes, because he woke you up, you're going to be with him. And the writing of this was, I'll get into that in my whip.
I mean, you want to go deeper. It's about the shallowness of the American male. There's 5,000 people on the ship he could have woken up. So let's go 50-50 and say 2,500 of them are female because he's a heterosexual male. He's got 2,500 women that he can go wake up. Does he go through and figure out compatibility? Does he try to find out anything about the people in there? No. He stumbles across a sexy blonde and says, this is the one. So we got the shallowness of the American male who, when he can go do the creepy thing he's going to do and wake one of them up and ruin their life and strand them with him on a lifeboat forever so that he's not alone, he just chooses the one that makes him go boing, boing, boing. And then her, who just says, well, I know he's a creep. I know he manipulated me into loving him. And I know I should be wanting him arrested for ruining my life and committing a crime against me. But I'm a woman and I need a man to be here with me and to help me. So he's good enough for me. It's God crap writing. You should be mad about it if you're a man. You should be mad about it if you're a woman.
Yeah, this love story is ham-fisted at best.
Yeah,
best.
I kind of got the same vibe as Thomas, though. I was thinking about it like this really isn't a love story as much as it's a practicality one. It's one of those things where if you put me on a desert island alone with a woman that otherwise I would never have any compatibility with, but just out of pure necessity of survival and to stave off madness from solitary life, I would just wind up with her. Maybe not romantically, but even if it did happen, it would be born of the fact of just this is the way it is. It's not like it would have to be like, all right, we're the only people here we have to deal with this.
Right. And there's another issue you just brought up that to stave off madness. This has nothing to do with madness. To stave off madness, A, you would go for compatibility, or you'd wake up a dude. It doesn't have to be a woman. A
couple other people. You would at least do a couple people.
Right.
But this is...
You would be like, well, let's see here. Let's get the crew because... You know, let's get the crew because I can replace the alternator on a Chevy, but I can't fix a reactor.
You can't get to the crew. That's the key part. The crew is locked behind the...
That's true.
So you can only get to passengers, but that still leaves the question, why not wake up a couple? Why not one or two? Oh, if you need companionship, you can wake up more than one. You could wake up, but no, you got to only wake up one. But it has to be the sexy woman that you're lusting after.
And then let's talk about this. This is supposed to be, again, the problem with the relationship. This is supposed to be a love story to show you the remarkable power of love and how beautiful love is and how human it is. And it's the only thing in the world that matters. Except you're literally saying two people that should never be together and a woman who should absolutely hate the man that she's with will eventually, if given enough time together, love each other. So you basically just said that love is bullcrap. And you might as well just liken it down to a disease that happens in the human brain in a chemical level. It's insulting to the concept of love. And then how about the fact that you didn't ever think it possible that you built your entire relationship on a lie and that she was somehow going to find out that you woke her up and see through your BS lie?
Now, I want to play Scott's advocate here for a minute. Something just did occur to me at this very minute. Now, it didn't, in no way, it probably will not invalidate anything we've already said, but I want to toss it out there. So she, of course, wanted to try him for murder, charge him with murder and all that, and you know, a justifiable charge, I suppose. But remember at the point where they found out she could go in that airlock or whatever and become and get put back into stasis.
Medical tube, and, yeah.
And he said, do it. Go ahead, do it. And well, he meant it.
I don't know if you couldn't charge with murder. I would say possibly kidnapping or.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, something, some kind of crime. But the point is, he was willing to let her go and say, all right, well, if you hate me, there's no point you being here. Go ahead and climb back in, and, you know, that'll be that. Maybe I'll see you when you wake up, but probably not. And the thing is, that kind of sacrifice would create a love-like situation. Now, again, let me throw this out there. I personally am not in favor of arranged marriages. But having spoken with and met people who have been in an arranged marriage, their view is, well, you love the person you marry. And the ones that I saw that succeeded happened usually because one of the people did something sacrificial to make it work. And the other person appreciated that and thought, I'll give it a go. And it worked out. Now, would it work for everybody? No, of course not. I'm not going to make that claim. That's too much. But in this case, it could have been a case where Aurora sees this sacrifice and realizes, you know what? The guy I did see is the guy is who he was. He wasn't putting up a facade. He didn't have to. Who else was he in competition with? So maybe that sacrifice pinged something justifiably in an individual.
I agree with you that it did.
So therefore, that would be the only way I could see her falling back in love, because the sacrifice was enough to make her say, wow, he really does love me, because
he's willing to
let me go. And it's painful. It's really painful. But he understands my point of view, and he's putting my concerns and needs above himself.
I would not go that far. Not even close. He's Chris Pratt, which definitely helps him. But let's be honest. If you got woken up by Chris Pratt or you got woken up by the creepy dude, which guy has a better chance?
For sure. That definitely factors
in. Wait, you think it goes differently if Steve Buscemi wakes her up?
Let me put this out there. I'm gonna 99.5% agree with you guys on that one, except there's a 0.5% here on the fact that it is much more likely to happen that a woman will fall for a guy that is way below her attractiveness level because of other factors. Women are much more likely to look past that than a guy. Okay. Now, again, and like I said, I'm still 99.5% on your guys' side.
Listen, look, I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to agree with you 100% that Mystique Aurora Lawrence has fallen back in love with Star-Lord Pratt Jim because of his actions. Because he's willing to sacrifice himself, and it's not even when he's going to put himself back in the auto dock tube. It's when he's going to spacewalk, basically, and she realizes he's going to go risk himself to save her. In that moment, she's already deciding that when she's reading the message from her friend that says, let that guy in. Which is, again, my problem with it is just stupid writing. Because the message from her friend isn't even relevant to everything that's gone on here. It's not like she's hardened her heart against the man for no reason. I mean, she found out something that, look, if she'd have brought the crowbar or whatever that was down on his head and killed him in the bed, we really wouldn't have blamed her.
No, not at all.
So none of it makes sense, but I will give you, and I'll even give you the realism of it. I'll give you the realism of everything that happened in this, and that given the idea of living 88 years with someone you hate, or living 88 years alone, 99% of us, unless you're the Lee Harvey Oswald type, are going to choose to live with the person you hate because at least it's one other person. You'd rather argue with that person than the android bartender.
Right. Now, this almost brings me to my rips and picks.
Yeah, we can do that. Slide in. Go ahead.
Because that is my biggest rip on this film, is the writing. For one, I can see every twist and turn coming a mile away.
That's for sure.
Like, I know exactly where this film's going. From the first time I saw it, I knew how it was going to end pretty much to the thing. Sure, there were a couple, trees grew.
Yeah.
But that's not a main plot twist. I'm talking every single main plot twist I saw coming. They telegraphed it so badly that it's like, I know what's happening in this film. I know when things are going to happen. I knew the entire arc of it basically from the beginning. Oh, he's by himself. He's going to find someone.
Yeah.
Oh, look, he found someone. The only question was a couple houses. Even the house most of the time was seen. I'm like, okay, it's something's failing, something's breaking.
How is it going to break?
Right. And it's like, it was very well seen. And we mentioned her name, Sleeping Beauty. I mean, nothing about this movie was subtle in any way.
For sure.
This, as I said, this was based, and as our title suggests, tight Anakin's base. She's the rich one. He's the lower class. It's worse than that because it's no one else.
It's derivative.
It's like,
it's derivative of multiple stories. You smash Sleeping Beauty and Titanic together, you've got 95% of this.
Right.
A little bit of The Shining with the bartender.
I get this is probably why it was in development hell for so long, but it makes me wonder, what was it that made them finally go for it? Because you can't, I mean, was it the star power? Because originally it was Keanu Reeves and Reese Witherspoon.
I think it's the star power.
It must be, because to me, it's like, I see why this was in development for so long. And
the other thing is, a romance film is generally a safe bet because you can get away with selling just the romance film. And if there's a feel good enough romance story involved, people will overlook a lot of really terrible, terrible flaws in the film.
Well, since I've ripped on it, I'm also going to bring up some picks here.
Oh, we have to.
Okay. The science in this, not too bad.
No. For
most of the science in here, pretty good. The ship design, I like. It's a very good, accurate-looking ship design, though I would probably put the bridge somewhere other than up there, but again, subtle ship design.
The bridge on any starship should be in the center of the ship.
Center.
It should never be where it is, okay? It's completely idiotic in every science fiction film for it to be on the top of the ship.
Yes, also that swimming pool would not have a porthole because that's a weak spot.
Yeah.
You don't put portholes. You don't put windows in a spaceship.
Yeah,
you don't.
Sure.
You just don't. You don't have the Enterprise where you can just look out at every single porthole.
Or a Star Destroyer.
Right. You don't have that stuff. But again, that's subtle. That's pretty much expected in a sci-fi movie, so I accept it. But also the aesthetic, the luxury liner, the time delay on messages. It's well done. And I have to also bring up the score. The music was well done.
Yeah.
And the sound effects. That was pretty good. But this, when I was rewatching this, I came across someone's comment on this film, which really made me think, and this is very true. They said that because of how it's put together, the editing of it, there is only real two paths at the end of this film. He dies or he lives. There is nothing else. And he's pretty quickly, because of how it's edited and you follow him at the beginning of the movie, he's going to live. It's almost guaranteed.
Yeah.
So they've basically, the writers, and again, terrible writing, have basically forced themselves down one path. He has to live. Well, this is all because you set up with him. And this guy mentioned it, and it made me think, this film would have been, I think, 10 times better. You could have still had this love story, but with one big caveat and one big change. You take the first act and you put it into the third act spot, and you move the first two acts up.
Okay. So like
start with Jennifer Lawrence waking up, and then you find that means this, he's been by himself for a year, which means the entire time is now suspicious. You wake up with her. Who is this guy? What's going on? Why is this happening? Why is he trying to break in here? Everything becomes much more of a suspicion and an interesting thing. And then you have the whole thing where you're following her, her point of view. And then the betrayal of him waking her up would be so much more powerful. You then could jump back to when he wakes up first. And then you can explain why he did it, showing him a year and depression and all that. But it would hit much harder. Both of those would.
It would. It's an example of where some editing they talked about Star Wars New Hope was saved in the editing. This could have, I don't know if it could have saved this film, because when I get to my rip, I'll say why I don't think anything could have saved it, but it would have made it better. It definitely would have made it better. The plot would have made more sense, and everything would have carried more power. And it logically makes sense if you're going to end the film with her to begin the film with her. Makes a ton more sense. And you could have even shown Chris Pratt. You could have used the whole first act in the third act spot and just flipped them. And everything would have been fine. Picks. I'll get a pick out here before I rip it. But yeah, Thomas, I agree with you 100% on that. Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence and Lawrence Fishburne almost make this movie good. And I had to really let this movie sit, because I'm going to tell you, when I first watched this movie this morning at 10:30, I thought I was going to come out at like a 6 or 6.5 on this film. And it's because their acting is phenomenal. You put Chris Pratt in a role for the first two acts of this film, basically, where he's on screen by himself with a little interaction with an android and some holographic characters. And it's a one-man movie for a long time. Then it's a two-person show with a little bit of help from Arthur the android. And then you get, for a minute, Lawrence Fishburne. You basically have four people carrying this film. And Michael Sheen, I can't leave him out. They almost make this work. And they gave a Herculean effort to get this film to be good. And it might be, honestly, their finest performances.
I would agree with you 100%.
Right, I would agree.
You would or wouldn't, Mark?
I would.
Yeah, it might be their finest performances as actors and an actress. Unfortunately, the entire concept of the film, I've only used this term in one other movie, and that was, I believe, The Wandering Earth. The entire film is based on an idiot premise. And this idiot premise is that the company is so certain that their habitation pods cannot malfunction that they have no contingency plan for if they do. They're also so certain that their ship can run on autopilot that they have no contingency to wake up the crew if something goes wrong. So
except they also bring enough spare parts to replace everything.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you don't bring spare parts on an indestructible ship.
When? Okay, so let's start with the crew. When the hell were you going to wake the crew up? It was struck by a meteor. There's a cascade failure. The ship, the reactor is about to explode. And you're still not trying to wake anybody up. When were you going to wake someone up? There's a massive critical failure. Beyond this, there's a person from the passenger manifest running around trying to break into the crew quarters, doing damage to things. And you're still not even going to wake up security? You're not just waking someone up every 10 years to check on shit to make to make sure it's okay? No.
Well, this also brings up another thing. How does a passenger have access to the entire cargo hold? He has complete access to everything except the bridge and the crew.
And the good everywhere breakfast menu. He's got unlimited alcohol, but he can't have the good bacon and eggs. Like that.
Okay, I'm gonna come up with a very bad excuse for that one that'll fail utterly, but I feel like playing this Scott's advocate today. Because bacon and eggs take up a lot more space than alcohol. Liquid is easier to take into space than a physical object.
I guess maybe they're not being a protein reconstitutor or something. But at any rate, it's an idiot premise that we're not going to wake up the crew at this point. They're never going to wake up the crew.
That's true. Wait. You go down there and you see cattle all in, stasis. Don't tell me they don't have weight for a few pounds of bacon. They got plenty of weight spacing. This is a luxury liner. Bacon is the least issue of their supplies.
Yeah. It's a good attempt at some devil's advocate.
It was not a good explanation.
We know the real reason he doesn't have access to bacon and eggs. It's to ham-fist in a class thing. Yeah. I mean, that's all it is. To say, look at what the haves and the have-nots don't. This man is an essential needed skill, and he has to eat the, Soylent Gray instead of Soylent Green Cube and plain coffee, and this woman is a rich journalist, so she can have everything. They wanted to jam that one in. But the biggest thing is the real idiot premise, the second idiot premise, and the main one is that there's no way to put him back into stasis and that the ship would just act like nothing happened and they have no contingency plan for that. That's absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, the ship knows. They're talking to him. They're like, welcome. We're 88 years out. Then what am I doing up? This is a semi-sentient ship. It has no way to put him back into stasis. The deckhand gets woken up. He's part of the crew, or the deck captain. He's part of the crew. He can't get put back into stasis. How is this possible?
Is that a death sentence
for anyone on the ship if they have to get woken up? I mean, if something goes wrong, there's no way to put the crew back into stasis.
And AI doesn't know how.
Yeah, and I can get that this is a corporation, so there would probably be some issues, but legal department of any corporation would sit there and have a heart attack with this type of ship design going, wait a minute, you're telling me that if anything goes wrong in this, there is no way of fixing it and there's no way to wake the crew up? And if someone does, wake up, what? It's like there's no safety mechanisms on any of this stuff or anywhere.
And this was my problem. Much like The Wandering Earth, and no matter what happened in the rest of that film, I couldn't get past the part that the main premise was that we're going to attach engines to the planet and move it. no matter what happened in the rest of this film, I couldn't get past the fact that there was no contingency plan for putting him back into hibernation. And that there was no contingency plan when the ship started malfunctioning to wake up the crew. Everything else that goes on, and there's some really good stuff in here. There's a usual deep meaning thing about never getting caught up so much in where you want to be that you forget to make the most out of where you are. And that would be fantastic. And there's a whole thing we could explore about the nature of love. And that even got taken out because it wasn't an exploration. They just gave you the answer. Love is awesome. Even when we're showing you that it's not, and we're doing everything we can to sabotage our own message. But I couldn't get past the idiot premise of, I can't put him back into hibernation. Everything, nothing in this film works if you don't start with the fact that, why can't we put him back into hibernation? Well, we just can't. Well, we have a good answer. We just can't.
They did explain it. And
What was that then? Because I completely forgot what it was.
And I would say this is almost good on them how they did it, because they explained it as they had to go to a place to be put under, and there's a whole bunch of procedures and systems that they needed to go through.
Yeah, but then they also said they also kept saying that's impossible. It's not possible. They're foolproof. They cannot, like the Titanic, it cannot be sunk. And then the computer says, or the auto doc or someone says, there's been 10,000 trips without a hibernation pod malfunction.
That I found completely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean,
everything else you put on that ship and how big it is, you could have got a robot that was capable of rehibernating someone, because I mean, it's just it's also impossible that you're going to send the crew out and not have a contingency plan to one, wake them if something goes wrong, like does, and then to put them back to sleep in the event that you woke them.
Correct.
Well, and, you know, let's go back to backpedal a little bit to something Tom has just said about legal department insurance. So they're claiming, the company is claiming that Homestead 2, or excuse me, Avalon, is nigh indestructible. Now, I get in the film Titanic, when they said God himself couldn't sink it, they were that foolhardy. And people are that foolhardy now. So to hear some company make that boast, sure, I could believe a company would say something like that. But then as soon as they made that claim, there'd be an insurance agent or lawyer going, yeah, I wish you hadn't done that. Let's bring that back a little bit, please, because you're going to get tested on that and we're going to get sued big time.
Well, so, even the Titanic was, when they said nigh indestructible and unsinkable, admittedly, it wasn't, but they had some idea why it was, because they thought we had tons of bulkheads. We know how much of the ship can take water and still not sink. We have science behind us.
Well,
except if you hit an iceberg at just the right angle and scrape along it and bust your seam open.
Which, something like the Titanic, you would think would make them realize, gee, maybe we shouldn't make that boast. But
there's something different about space.
Yeah, you would think a scientist would be like, wait a second. So a meteor, you're going at half FTL. A meteor hits you. Let's just say it's the size of a small rock.
Well, it's going to even say a rock, hull. Which technically speaking, I was going to bring this up. That meteor was huge.
Going to rip your hull to shreds.
That meteor hitting them would have gotten enough kinetic energy into that ship that it should have sheared the ship apart.
Because kaboom! It should have been practically a nuclear explosion.
Well, not only that, because if you know anything about kinetic energy's math on it is very simple. It's mass times the speed that the object is going squared. The speed is the important thing, not the mass. Yeah,
that's why.
The ship hit it at half the speed of light. That thing should have wrecked the ship, not just plowed a nice clean hole in it. Maybe it was a speck of dust, but even then, but something that big should have just taken the ship to atoms. Right.
I remember seeing things on the show The Universe where they did like a space combat episode, and they had something called like the Rod of God. It was just a long titanium rod the size of a telephone pole. That's like, no, we don't need to have explosives on it. Just drop it at the Earth from far enough away. The kinetic energy alone will equal any nuclear weapon.
Look up railguns. The U.S. Navy's development of railguns. No explosive ammo being used.
Don't need it.
Kinetic energy to literally sink ships out hundreds of miles away.
You don't need the explosives.
Right. So that's where it's like, a meteor somehow getting through this magic shield that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Somehow structurally being able to just put a hole in the thing and not blow it apart.
It hit it and just like careened enough to do damage, but not enough to continue the destructive path it should have done. But to that end, a scientist would know that and say, are you sure you really want to bank on the Holdo maneuver not working? Are you sure about that? So I don't see how anyone would have been, how anyone with a brain would have been foolhardy enough to say that. But then it also goes back to how come it only opened up this pod and how come no one else could go back in? And it all just goes back to the J.J. Abrams, because it does.
Well, it also wakes up the only mechanics on the ship too. So it's like,
imagine it had been like Aurora woke up. It's like, well, she's screwed.
A less significant rip, but let's talk about Arthur the Android. Why is he up and running? There's not going to be a customer at the bar for 90 years. The pods are foolproof. There's no way to wake up the crew, apparently. There's no way to put him back to sleep. Why wasn't he just in, like, standby power down mode he in standby power down mode until he sensed a human being?
I think that was it, but at the same time, you would think him being plugged into the ship's computer would be like, hey, you're up a little early.
Well, again, this goes back to the computer not being able to be sentient or being able to, it's supposed to be a smart computer that's controlling the whole ship, but can't figure out that A, there's been a malfunction, B, there's multiple malfunctions that actually are destroying the ship. Nope, can't figure that one out.
Yeah, right.
There's like, definitely a human being or two moving around on the ship that shouldn't be.
Right, because you've now woken up the whole system. How early? We're talking hundreds of years early, and you go, we don't have supplies for this. We don't have equipment for this. Nothing. Just go, I'm just supposed to run. That's it. Don't care about the ship blowing up around me.
Yeah, my car's hazard light still goes off for a light that's not out. And this ship can't even, like, accidentally find a flaw.
I think it is nice to know in the future that androids are Captain Kirk-proof, because when Star-Lord hits him with that little logic puzzle of, how am I here?
It just resets.
Right, a Captain Kirk android would have just went into a complete meltdown and just, like, literally melted down and exploded in front of you. This android just goes, okay, you shouldn't be here, and then moves on with his life. Like anything should have.
Yeah. Well, it basically had a memory glitch where it just went, oop, memory overload, dump, reset. That's it.
And then, last thing on Arthur the Android. Why is he going haywire? He's a self-contained android that just has a linkage to the ship. Like, his program is contained in that thing. It's just there to tug on your heartstrings. It's a filler scene to feel bad for Arthur. I mean, it makes no sense. I guess you could say that since he's connected to the ship's computer, which I don't know if he is or isn't, it's a cascade failure. It's not a virus. Like, the ship shouldn't be stealing resources from the bartending android to solve these problems. It should be pulling them from much bigger places for the processing capacity.
Well, this again brings up issues that pretty much every sci-fi writer has, where they don't understand things. They don't understand basic science sometimes, or computers, or whatever. In this case, you go, so you built a computer that is barely powerful enough to control this, because apparently the damaging of the one cell has to draw power from everything else.
Right.
Right. Where was the reserve capacity?
Right. It's like, in simpler terms, you built no reserve capacity. You built no backup capacity.
The ships are indestructible. Why would you make backups?
Because you want to make it indestructible. Like, there's no, and anyone who knows anything about computers knows you have to have backup. You have to have reserve capacity. If you're running a computer at max CPU, max RAM, and max hard drive, it's not going to work.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like saying, okay, guys, what do we got here? This the computer needs 16 gigabytes of RAM to run this autopilot and auto-maintain software. It takes 15.7 gigabytes of RAM. How much RAM we got? 16. What happens if we lose any one system? We won't lose that system. Should we go to 32? No, we're fine. 16 is what we need. Budgetary concerns, man. Got quarterly profits to hit.
Okay, Scott, you just led me into my Scott's Advocate. Today I got a ton of these. But again, I'm still agreeing with the general consensus here, but I'm going to throw Scott's Advocate out there. One, on the Titanic, they did not have extra lifeboats, assuming they wouldn't need them. So yes. Could we do that again? Yes.
No. Two, we don't even have lifeboats on this. You're in interstellar space.
Right.
Well, yes. But what I'm saying is, you can't do that anymore. It's literally been international law that you have enough lifeboats now.
The corollary is just that people will overlook A and B. Scott, we're talking about a megacorp.
Yeah.
And if a megacorp is told, well, you need 16 megs to run, that's what they will buy. In fact, they might even try to make it 12 to get a deal on it. They'll nickel it. They will step over a dollar to save a dime.
Well, you're right. If we ever need any more evidence about why corporations can't regulate themselves, we need an international law that you have to have enough lifeboats for every passenger on a ship. And we needed that law to get that law passed. A ship had to sink without enough lifeboats.
Right. So I'm just saying, though, you would also think that a corporation would actually probably do something here, because the liability on him waking up early is terrible. He's probably dead by the time it makes it there, but they owe his family so much money. He sent a message out.
Oh, they can't deny it. Yeah.
Oh, well, they're sweeping that all under the rug. It's like Enron. Shred, 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 shred.
Exactly. So we're talking about a corporation here, and they would do everything they can to cover it, nickel and dime it, and, I mean, screw everybody over. So, again,
let's play out how this message he sent out went. Boss, I got a message from this guy on the ship. He says he woke up early, doesn't know how to get back in. You didn't get a message. No, I got a message. You did not get a message.
Did not get a message.
Then later on, when that person gets home, they get a message from the company's security that throws them around a little bit and says, we're just going to be hanging out wherever you go for a while. You didn't get a message.
Or legal department calls them up and says, as a member of the board, you did not see this.
Right. Or here, we're going to offer you $10 million, but you got to sign this NDA.
Yeah, pretty much.
It says you're going to jail if you say anything about this incident. That's more realistic.
Yeah, and I'm not disagreeing with you. And again, this film has quite a few areas where it gets things very unrealistic, and we've explored quite a bit of them. But we talked earlier about editing. I have one question for you, both of you. And this is what I said the first time I saw this film. And I told this to my wife as we left the theater. I thought this film would have been so much better if he died at the end. Let me finish. At the very end, but I'm talking...
When you open the port to
let the stuff out.
Vent the stupid gas.
Right. Vent the stupid gas. If he had died right then venting the gas, and then with him dead, the movie ended with her having the dilemma and staring at another sleeping pod with a guy in it, withholding like the book that she found that he had on the how to operate those things. And her having to make the decision if she does what he did to her.
Now, that is a very, very, very compelling ending, which I think is far better. But that would also make it from a romance to a tragedy. So that's not what they were going for.
I'm fine with it being a romantic tragedy.
I find it a much more
better as a romance, as a tragedy and whole.
Well, I find it as a much more satisfying ending. I'll tell you that much.
Any ending would be more satisfying, but that's actually a good ending. This isn't an ending. It really isn't. One miracle spacesuit happens to withstand the whole pressure of the venting reactor that the containment chamber around the reactor couldn't withstand. But his spacesuit and chunk of metal. So the chunk of metal he took as a heat shield stands up when the stuff within the ship that he took it from can't stand up.
Yeah.
So survives because
this thing is indestructible on the right side. See, the plates that were in there weren't flipped around the right way. That's why.
Oh, I got it. Yeah, it makes as much sense as J.J. Abrams' black hole in the center of the solar system that does no damage to anything else ever. It just closes in on itself. Fine. That's idiotic. Yeah, he should have died right then and there. Noble sacrifice, redeems himself, and she can write a story and have something about, you know, people can make horrific mistakes, but you got to keep looking through to see what the true nature of their character is. And if you give people a chance to all the good stuff you could have done with science fiction, and it had been great, and have her explore her own dilemma and not know if she woke up Steve Buscemi or not. You know, and that would be fantastic. And instead, you get she chooses not to go back into the stasis tube. And I guess they get married. And they don't have any kids? Do they have kids? They don't have kids?
Yeah,
they
put the kid in the stasis
tube? This is it. This is literally
is my birth control just that good in the future? Is Star-Lord had to get snipped? I mean,
well, the ending is what really ruins it for me. The film is okay.
You grew a garden.
Up to the very end. And the very end kills it for me because it's like the captain and the rest of the crew wakes up because you're there. But you now get introduced by a story. Okay, they're dead apparently. Did they have kids? We don't know. Then why is the ship still operating? Why is the ship have plants in it? Why is robots harvesting fruits? You see a robot moving fruit around. Did they just set the entire ship up on autopilot for when they died? Do they have kids now? What happens? It's like the worst ending where it ends on a cliffhanger, but not a good cliffhanger.
Right, because they've been dead for, God, at least 30 years. At least.
We don't know how long life expectancies are now.
It sounds like it's a normal life expectancy because they both said, he said, I'm going to die of old age on this ship. There's nothing makes you think they have longer life expectancies.
Except who knows what the auto dock does. It's a MacGuffin that is a terrible MacGuffin that's like, oh, you can put someone to sleep in it, but also somehow it can heal a lot of stuff, but it can't heal this, but it could heal that. And you just go, who knows?
And it's not even a satisfying ending for her because did she learn a lesson? What's the lesson? Don't be so obsessed with where you want to be that you forget where you are.
Live in the moment?
I mean, maybe? Yeah.
The ending is weird and just ends on such a note that's a bad taste in my mouth, personally.
We kind of get her motivation, but we really don't. You know, she wants to be able to tell a story like April O'Neil, my story. And then her friend says, you don't got to do this to go do what you got to do. You could have done it on Earth. He could have found a story on Earth. I mean, a story is what you make it. Anything can be a story if you're a talented writer. You just got to say, this is what I'm going to write about. You know, writers will say it all the time. You want to be a writer, write. Don't think about being a writer. You got to write. Don't wait for your story to hit you. You got to write. And Chris Pratt's motivation doesn't make a whole ton of sense either. I'm a mechanic. I want to go where things need fixed. I guess I get that. He just wants to go live a simple life of a tinkerer fixing things. And on Earth, you can't tinker and fix things. Okay. They're not giving you an explanation for why people want to leave Earth. They're not giving you the explanation for the questions they ask. They ask all these questions and they don't answer them. They have this whole thing about she doesn't know people. If you're going to be a writer, you got to know people. And then they do nothing in the rest of the story to show you how she learns to read people. He shows her in the second act that she can't read anybody. They did that, and it's just gone. They talk about his desire to be a tinkerer and build a home, and then it's just gone. I don't know why he had to grow a tree. It's like Bran becoming a tree. There's not a thing in this movie that makes sense.
Apparently they build a life together at the end, but what kind of life?
We don't know anything about it.
Right. We don't know if it was a happy life, a sad life, kids, not kids.
What a life. They're swimming in the hotel pool together, looking out the viewport. I'm going to be honest with you. The hotel pool is pretty cool for about an hour. After an hour of swimming in the hotel pool, no matter how cool the view is, okay. They try to tell you their great life together is swimming in the hotel pool and looking out at the view of space, and it's a great life. Why is it a great life? Because you're spending it with the guy that creepily woke you up so that you couldn't live the life you wanted because he was lusting after you?
Well, not just that, but this is another thing. What is a life? What is a great life? Not what is a life, but what is a great life? what, you just lived the rest of your life eating sushi and fancy restaurants and drinking at the bar? What kind of life is that?
Well, oh, the hedonism? Don't forget the gardening.
It's kind of like hedonism. It's like, hey, I got this five-star resort with my own personal bartender, unlimited supply of free food and liquor, and resort entertainment. And look, that's a lot of fun for a vacation. It becomes pretty meaningless, I'm going to guess, after first 6 months.
Well, now, again, it did show you pretty well that Chris Pratt's character, within a year, got bored of everything. You notice at the end, he's sitting there with a basketball. I'm not, you don't even care about this anymore. And that works because that's honest and true. Even anyone after a year playing basketball, and that's all you do because that's all you got, it's going to get boring. It's going to get tiresome. What you play that for entertainment after work or something. It makes sense. But if that's all you got, that's going to get boring fast. And this is just, wow, what kind of life did they have?
I think COVID has taught a lot of people a lot of things about the value of human interaction. Okay, I tend to be an introverted person. But over the last almost year at this point, okay, I haven't been in a social circle very much, okay? I haven't been going to work very much. I probably have been into the office physically 30 days this year. Maybe 30 days physically in the office. And aside from my wedding, I don't think I've been to a big social event. I've gone to a couple family birthday parties and, you know, finally did something yesterday outdoors. I tried to get back into playing football for a couple of weeks and that got shut down. For the most part, I am in my house and it's me and my wife and my dog. And all of my interaction is over the phone, over Skype, over email, over text. And yes, I'm still getting out occasionally, go to the store. I'm still getting out occasionally to do certain things. But for the most part, I have been isolated. And when you're isolated, you tend to realize that things don't mean as much as you think they mean without people to share the experience with. We are social animals. And this story is saying they built a great life with just each other and an Android bartender with what you can do at Sandals Jamaica in space or a cruise ship in space. I don't buy it. All of this stuff that this is, you know, there was a potential to really show you something, but they wanted a feel good story instead of what they should have done, Thomas, as you said, and be a tragedy. And all the meaning that it's trying to tell you about human life becomes trite and a BS fairy tale. It might as well be Sleeping Beauty, because ultimately, look, you know what made Titanic so good? Jack died and floated away off of the piece of wood because Rose couldn't scoot her butt over a little bit and help him up.
I still don't think I never have seen that film, but I'm never going to see the film. I know it sucks. Personally,
yeah, I can't believe I said what made it so good. But what made Titanic so beloved by people is that Jack died.
Okay.
And yes. Rose went on and had a great life.
Yes.
I'll give you that. Well, yeah. And that's, again, this film, it feels like it has the bones of something good. And there's some parts of it that are good. But it just leaves me with such a bad taste from some of these things. These plot points and these ideas and how it ends, that for me, this is actually a bad film. And honestly, I had forgotten how bad this was because, again, I saw this when it first came out with my wife. And honestly, I probably liked it mostly because of that, because I was with her. But I forgot this. It was a forgettable film. I'm like, oh yeah, this was a film I saw. I totally forgot what it was. I'm like, I thought it was okay. I'll have to see it. I rewatched it, and my viewpoint on it went up from it's trash to, oh, there's some good points to it. But rewatching it reminded me of all this stuff I hated about it and how bad it was and how it ended poorly and everything, that it's just like, ah, and I don't know how to say it, but I feel bad that I had to watch it again.
Ouch. I think that takes us to a point of rating this then in that case. And since Thomas, you feel bad about watching it again, how about you rate it? Oh, we're going to be rating it. How many
meteor strikes?
How many auroras? It's a fun word to say. How many auroras?
Man. Okay, if I can't say this is a one, I can't say it's complete trash. I can't, and I don't think I can say five being it's the middle of the road. I think I have to go. It's 4 or 3, one of those two, 3 or 4. It's kind of a meh. It's forgettable. I mean, I honestly forgot most of this film before rewatching it. It's just meh. And leaves me with a bad taste at the end that's just ugh. Actually, 3. With the bad taste, it definitely drops it down to 3.
Now that you're thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, this is an example of how to kill a superb acting, directing, and musical score. Because you get an absolutely the four actors and actress, the actress and the three actors who are required to make this film happen, do an amazing job and beyond amazing. You couldn't get a better performance out of them. I don't think you could ask for a better performance out of any of them. And I can't find a single flaw watching that film with that performance. And to get that performance, that means the direction had to be fantastic. And the camera work and the overall effects editing and the sound work and the sound design, superb. Unfortunately, and you even had good concepts buried in there somewhere that just needed polished. But unfortunately, the movie requires two implausible, completely implausible and unbelievable premises to work. And it should have stayed trapped in development, and it should have never been greenlit, because you're spending the entire film overcoming these bad assumptions that you have to make. It's like a logical argument, premise A and premise B, and if they're true, then conclusion C. But premise A and premise B is purple monkey and pink elephant, and the conclusion is lion, and it doesn't work. And unfortunately, it just never should have been made. Now, someone can tell me it obviously should have, because it made $300 million, and I feel like I'm taking Mark's role this week and he's taking mine. But I'm amazed it broke even. But it's a three. I agree with Thomas. It's a three. And it's only a three because of heroic performances from the actress and actors.
Okay, so yeah, I would start with the fact that the actors did a great job. They were one of the strengths of this film, especially when Chris Pratt was by himself. That does take great acting and also great directing. So that's not a flaw. The look of this film is great. I like how, as Thomas, you pointed out, the science is, for what it is as sound as it's going to get. And the ship looks great. The concept of at least people going in cryogenic tubes to another place is feasible. That's about where it ends. And the love story, now that I reflect on what I said earlier with the sacrifice, that's conceivable now. Now that I think about it, is it a guarantee? No, it's not. But it could work. Unfortunately, that stops at, as Scott points out, the idiot premise, the abundance of coincidences and Abrams style writing of shut up and don't ask questions. Just accept it. That's the way it is. You know, how come the cascading failure occurred this way? Where's their backup power? How come the meteor didn't destroy the whole ship? Why did it take so long for all these cascading failures? And so on and so forth. It just piles up to the point where you're verisimilitude, you're taken out of the story verisimilitude is not achieved. And to that end, it really takes it down to about a four, maybe a five if I'm feeling sentimental, but four. That's the for the look and the acting, but and that's about it. That's where it ends with me. So, and that is our take on Passengers. So, Sickies, if you want, if you've seen this, you and disagree with us or agree with us, you can comment at
RavingLunaticMedia.com. RavingLunaticMedia.com. That's RavingLunaticMedia.com. Rage Master, what's left for them to do?
Stay sick, Sickies.
Let's make sure history never forgets the name.
Sci-Fi Malady.
Got out.